Hi, I'm Grant Wall, and welcome to the Planet Football Podcast, where I go in-depth with the most intriguing people in the world of soccer. In this episode, I'm joined by Jonathan Liu, the UK-based chief sports writer for The Independent, who I think is one of the best sports writers working in English today. I think you'll like this conversation. Just a quick reminder, it's a huge help if you subscribe to, rate, and review the podcast. It helps people find us. Onward! Our guest today is Jonathan Liu, the chief sports writer for The Independent in the UK. He is one of the world's premier sports writers, covering an array of sports, especially soccer and cricket. Jonathan, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. Quite an intro. Thank you very much for that.
Well, that's how I feel, and I think a lot of people feel that way about your work. It's something where I think one of the wonderful things about Twitter, and there's certainly some negative things, but one of the wonderful things about Twitter is it's exposed me on a regular basis to great writing, great journalists around the world that I'm able to read on a more regular basis. So I just said something positive about Twitter.
There's always a time and a place.
I wanted to have you on the podcast because I find so often that your columns and stories after a big game or on other occasions are the ones that are the most perceptive and thought-provoking that I read. And I want to start with what seems like a pretty simple question. What are you asked to do for your job? It seems like sort of a variety of things.
Yeah, gosh, I suppose the short answer to that is very little. One of the good things about working at the Independent, it's quite a young team and quite a small team as well, is that we as writers get quite a lot of latitude to sort of not cover what we want necessarily, but pick out the angles and the stories and the characters and the themes that appeal to us, which I think is quite rare, certainly in sort of traditional English newspaper journalism. An example, I went to Fulham against Huddersfield a few weeks ago and you know, found something reasonably interesting to say about what quite a dull game. So that's part of what I do. I also cover quite a lot of, you know, diary stuff, as we call it. You know, that's press conferences and matches, and as well as football, I do mainly cricket, but you know, a variety of other things as they pop up.
I think one of the challenges, and we'll get into a little bit about the compare and contrast between UK writing and sports and maybe in the US, but one thing I do find that's similar, I think, in both countries is that there is this sort of hamster wheel trend in modern media where you're being asked to write so much about a lot of the same things that other journalists are writing about. And with so many platforms these days, it's maybe a challenge at times to find something new and interesting to say. How do you approach that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point, actually, that as a website, we're kind of driven by what people want to read. And so if you really wanted to, you could just write about Arsenal, Manchester United, Chelsea, Liverpool, ad infinitum, and, you know, make a fairly good living out of it. And lots of people do. Personally, I find you kind of run out of things, interesting things to say about, you know, about a lot of these themes after a while. I mean, I was kind of delighted when Jose Mourinho got sacked at Manchester United, because I have no new thoughts about Jose Mourinho anymore. It's just good for him to sort of go away for a couple of years, so I could think about something else I want to say about him. But equally, the other side of this is that because so many websites and outlets are focusing so heavily on what we would call the big traffic clubs, and I'd include Real Madrid and Barcelona in that as well, there are so many other stories and themes in football that are not getting enough coverage. And so while there is, you know, while it's, I guess, that hamster wheel trend is quite prevalent, if you know where to look and you have a little bit of, a bit of an intrepid spirit, it's actually easier these days to find stories that are undercovered, because there's so much out there that's just kind of in the shadows.
Yeah. Could you mention a couple of examples of maybe stories you've done in recent months that you felt good about finding a story that was undercovered?
Yeah. I mean, the FA Cup third round, which we just had in England in the sort of first week of January, it's a great one. I mean, the FA Cup's always brilliant for for bringing smaller clubs and sort of lower league teams into the, you know, into the spotlight just for a while. And so, I mean, there are so many stories in the FA Cup third round. If you want to look for them, a lot of them were very well covered. I personally went up to Grimsby Town, who are a team in League Two, the fourth tier, and it's right up on the east coast of England. I think it's in Lincolnshire, just right on the North Sea. It's pretty remote. You have no reason to go to Grimsby unless you were going to Grimsby. But they have a very interesting manager called Michael Jolly, who has no formal playing experience. He was a bond trader, actually. He left university and he went to Cambridge University, which is rare enough in itself. Became a bond trader, worked for HSBC in New York. He was in New York on the day of the 9/11 attacks. Came back to England, started training for his coaching badges, and sort of worked his way into a Football League job, really quite an unconventional route. Those are the sort of stories that you maybe won't read every week, but something like the FA Cup third round is a really good opportunity to tell those sorts of stories and meet these kind of people and frankly, go to Grimsby, which is something I never thought I'd do.
There does seem to be sort of a basic difference between sports writing in the US and in England, at least from my perspective, in the sense that here in the US, it's often more access driven based on quotes from the athletes. And my sense is in England, a match report is at least seen as something more like, I don't know, a theater review. Am I oversimplifying this?
No, I think that's that's quite accurate. The locker room access that you guys get in the US, which I suppose is just part of the sporting culture there and always has been, it really doesn't exist here, certainly not anymore. Maybe 20 or 30 years ago, you would be able to, if you were covering a big club, even like Manchester United, you'd be able to go into the car park and have a chat with the player and the managers, but that just doesn't happen anymore. And so when you are writing about a match, it's very much being informed by what you see rather than who you talk to. Now, the best journalists will have, a mixture of insight, learned knowledge and good contacts. But it's interesting when you go to Jurgen Klopp press conference, for example, and you're asking him questions, and it's almost as if he doesn't really want to engage with them. He'll often say something like, "Well, you saw the match, you write about it, write what you want, right? Well, what are you asking me for? Form your own opinions." And I think that's becoming more prevalent. Like, what do you want to talk to me for? Leave me alone and form your own opinion so I can freely ignore them.
It's kind of fascinating to me, and I'm sure you run into situations like I've run into before where this happens with some regularity, where you're writing during a game. Sometimes, like, I'll usually have to write something if it's like I'm covering a U.S. national team game. I'll have my three quick thoughts at the final whistle, and I'll start writing in minute 70, and then there will be like a 90-second minute goal. Yeah. And you have to completely change everything, to the point where I should have kept all of the things I had written over the years, like ripping the U.S. for going out in the group stage of the World Cup in 2010 before the injury time goal. How often does that happen to you when you have to basically tear up something that you've been writing?
Fairly often. I suppose over time you kind of learn not to hedge your bets too much. But if you're writing for a print newspaper, as I used to do at the Telegraph, it's unavoidable. The game often finishes at 10 p.m. The paper goes to print at 10:10, 10:15. So essentially you do have to file on the whistle. Alex Ferguson always used to kind of chide the football writers after they won the European Cup in 1999, scoring two goals in injury time against Bayern Munich. He used to taunt the journalist, saying he still has the first editions from that game, which were essentially about 70 or 80%. Manchester United so close, but yet so far, and then sort of two lines at the top: Manchester United won the European Cup in thrilling circumstances. It does happen quite a lot. We call them intro killers in the business. Late goals. The nightmare is when you get a late goal and then another late goal for the other side. It happens a lot more than we'd like. But I suppose one of the skills is kind of writing during the game in a way that could go either way. So you're coming up with interesting thoughts on the game that aren't necessarily contingent on the result. That's something I think you learn over time.
Now, you talked a little bit about undercovered stories that you like to latch on to. There's also stories that are not undercover, but are still really important and capture the attention of people around the world. And you're on the ground in England for one of the great running stories we've seen in recent years, Liverpool's pursuit of its first league title in 29 years. What do you think are some of the most intriguing aspects of that story, and how are you approaching covering a team that's getting covered a ton?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question, because I mean, the way that social media works and the news cycle, you're kind of bombarded with opinions. It's like an endless waterfall of takes and counter takes and revisionism, and I think one of the most interesting themes about this title race is, for a lot of neutrals, who should we be rooting for? That's something you never used to get in football journalism. This kind of veneer of impartiality was pretty much the industry standard. Now with fan blogs, with fans on Twitter, with message boards, with journalists' own prejudices being scrutinized because we're all fans of a club, whoever it is, we're seeing a lot more. We're seeing partisanship, I think, brought more into the story. And so, you know, there's been a long, kind of long running debate in the last sort of few months about who should we want to win the title. I think Henry Winter wrote something for the Times that all neutrals should be rooting for Liverpool because they are run in the way that a club should be run, with a ties to its community and what have you. And they play football in the right way, and they you know, that obviously created a very strong reaction, because mainly from Manchester City fans who think that, you know, the way their club is, you know, the story that, you know, the journey they've been on over the last 20 years is you know, pretty remarkable in itself. So I think that's one of the most interesting themes that's come through. I mean, in terms of you know, who's actually going to win it, I mean, who knows, right? Toss a coin.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me because I've started to do TV in the U.S. in recent years. I've been at Sports Illustrated as a writer for a lot longer. But even on TV, I've read that NBC, which shows the Premier League games here in the States, is very specific with its talent about not ever saying "we" to describe a team in the Premier League. You know, you're not one of them. And they're very clear about that. When I've worked for Fox Sports in television coverage, and maybe this is different because it's the World Cup and it's national teams, but they actually have no issue and sort of at times encourage the people at Fox Sports TV, the talent, to speak in "we" terms. I think our industry is sort of struggling with how to approach all of this.
Yeah, and I think there's a slight sort of disparity between the US and the UK in this. I think over in America, you guys have the journalism culture is I think a lot more formalized. In that you guys are taught ethics, but also this idea of impartiality is really embedded. Whereas in this country, that's, like I said, it's sort of eroding. And on TV, you will see pundits very frequently saying "we," you know, you let Paul Scholes or Ian Wright, who will openly root for their clubs and speak from the point of view of a fan of that club, which I guess essentially they are. And, you know, I suppose the argument in favour of that is everybody knows what their prejudices are, and as long as they're open about it, you know, that's in a way more honest. But yeah, that's very much the way things are going. That you know, it obviously came to a head during the World Cup when Gareth Southgate, the England manager, came out and said, "Does the media want to help the England team or not?" And this created quite a rift between people who thought, "Well, no, the media's job is not to help the England team; it's to report the news impartially," and others who thought, "Well, our job is to serve the market, and our market is England fans." So, you know, it's an interesting debate.
It is. I mean, I always grew up with the edict of no cheering in the press box, and I've even felt uncomfortable at times when on TV I've had someone put a U.S. scarf around me on air, you know, and so it's an interesting one to negotiate. Kind of moving to a different topic, but a really important one. You've written really eloquently on the topic of racism in soccer over the years. I can think back to your columns on the Jamie Vardy incident a few years ago. You wrote another column on racism in football in December after the Raheem Sterling Instagram post. And I don't want to embarrass you here, but I'm actually going to read from the column because I thought it was really well done.
No. Oh, no.
Oh, here we go. You wrote, quote, "You see, there's long been a fundamental problem with the racism debate in this country. A startling number of people don't really know what it is, never suffered it, never been affected by it, never really examined it in any great detail, and thus laboring under the first misconception of racism, that it is essentially all about incidents, that it must consist of a single discrete act, that it has to be intentional. Put more simply, there's an extremely high proportion of the population who believe that racism is simply stuff like shouting the N-word, putting a brick through a window, desecrating a Jewish cemetery, throwing bananas, and nothing else." Then you move on. "For the unenlightened, the idea that racism can be structural and endemic, subtle and unseen, unspoken, or even unintentional is about as intelligible as calculus. For them, it's a binary thing. You're either a racist or you're not. Indeed, these days, especially in online discourse, you often see this dialectic weaponized by the reactionary right as a sort of absurdist distraction," end quote. What sort of response did you get to that column?
Mixed, I'd say, but there was, I think, broadly supportive. I know it's Twitter, and essentially, we've curated our own Twitter feed and our own personal brand, so we only ever really hear the stuff that we want to hear anyway. But I was really encouraged by this whole episode, and not just the stuff that I wrote, but stuff a lot of other people wrote, and the debate that was being had in the media, on TV and in newspapers. I think we're actually getting somewhere here. I think for Raheem Sterling to come out and talk about structural racism, which is not a concept that is as easy to understand as kind of overt racist abuse, for him to sort of discuss that topic so eloquently, I think was an important step in bringing that home to a lot of people. And I mean, I was writing about Raheem Sterling sort of 2 or 3 years ago when he moved from Liverpool to Manchester City, and a lot of the criticism he got for, you know, taking a larger contract, for moving to a different club, for holding Liverpool to ransom as it was quite racialized in tone. But because it wasn't, you know, an overt act, because it wasn't necessarily intentional, people didn't recognize it as such. So I think there has been a little bit of a breakthrough in the last 2 or 3 years. Again, it's another good thing about social media. There are two good things about Twitter on this podcast, that it's exposed people to a broader range of views, and I suppose the discussion has moved on so many more stages than it might have done in a kind of a pre-internet age, and I think that's really encouraging.
You know, the sport of soccer, football, is getting bigger all the time here in the States, and we've got plenty of our own racist history, racist present, including connected to sports. But I do think there's still an element of people in the U.S. who are starting to follow European soccer, and that can be in England, that can be on other parts of the continent, and are stunned that in the year 2019, we still see bananas thrown at players in Europe, or outright racist chants, or even after the Koulibaly situation, where he was abused racially, the Napoli player, Napoli fans thinking they were being supportive by dressing up in blackface. What for those Americans who are sort of seeing this and seeing sort of these overt things that we have our own stuff here in the U.S., but you don't see that in U.S. stadiums. What's your take on the topic of racism in football at this point, and where we're going with it?
Yeah, I think part of that has to do with class slightly. I think in most of Europe, in most of, I guess, Latin America as well, football has traditionally been the sport of, you know, working people and, you know, the blue collar. Is it all right to say blue collar? Is that problematic?
No, that's good. Yeah,
it's essentially been a blue collar sport with all the good and bad that comes with that. in America, I mean, I guess I'm not an expert in kind of the demographics of US soccer, but I would imagine that if only soccer fans would have been allowed to vote in the presidential election, Trump would probably have come third behind Jill Stein, right?
True.
It's a slightly different demographic, and one that I think is probably more, you know, for want of a better word, a little bit more woke. And so, yes, it is going to be shocking for, you know, a lot of US fans to see bananas getting thrown and, you know, racist banners or kind of some of the stuff that happens in Russia. But to reiterate what I said earlier, I think it's good that we're having a conversation about it now. The fact that, far right, you know, racist politics is so prevalent throughout a lot of Europe is, you know, while awful, has brought the conversation into sports stadiums in a way that it might not have done otherwise. And so I'm essentially an optimist on this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I think that the more we talk about these issues, and the more, you know, for example, the Koulibaly issue, the more fans and administrators and players, you know, everybody in the game is kind of, as long as there's something pushing back on that, I think that's generally a positive thing. I don't trust FIFA to deal with it at all. I think this is the sort of change that comes from, you know, a more kind of popular movement, whether that's mm-hmm. through social media or whether that's through fan movements or whatever. I am generally optimistic.
Wanted to step back just a little bit here and ask you, you're a pretty young guy. What's your age?
33, a couple of months ago.
Okay. You're a young guy.
Youthful in terms of, you know, youthful in looks, I think. I still get ID'd now and again.
What was your pathway to becoming a sports journalist?
I went to Edinburgh University, and when I got to my fourth year, we do 4-year degrees in Scotland, I sort of, you know, panicked a little bit. I wrote for the student newspaper, but I didn't really envisage becoming a sports writer, because it was almost like saying I want to become an astronaut. there was something kind of distant and unattainable about it. But little steps were all kind of logical in their own way. I did some work experience at the Observer Sport Monthly, which was like a great magazine that the Observer used to run, which was a really good experience. I did some work experience at a cricket magazine, and then I joined the Telegraph's graduate scheme in 2008, and mm-hmm. there I sort of trained as a news journalist. I got kind of the shorthand and media law and all the kind of basics, and there just happened to be a vacancy on sport, and nobody else on my intake was really that fussed about sport. So that's kind of how it opened up. I'm really optimistic about sports writing generally. I think there's more great stuff out there than there's ever been. Mm-hmm. The finances of the industry, I think, are a lot more worrying, that mm-hmm. a lot of incredibly talented people aren't getting paid a huge amount, and there is still far too many kind of entry routes to the industry that are based on contacts or sometimes blind luck. And I guess in my case, it was blind luck.
Well, we have quite a few young journalists and aspiring journalists listening to this podcast. Would you have any useful pieces of advice for them and how to approach their job, or any useful tricks of the trade?
Yeah, I mean, I do get asked this quite a lot, and I generally try and say something different every time, because I think a lot of the advice is quite boring, but also quite, you know, it's also quite correct. You just have to keep writing and write and write and write until you feel like you know your craft, and you know words and sentences, and you know how writing works as well as you possibly can. And I think in a way that's more important than getting to know your subject matter. I think I like to think that a good writer should be able to turn themselves to anything, and certainly, you know, covering a range of sports, it's a kind of a handy surrogate for actually knowing stuff. So that would be one thing I would suggest. But also, I think trying to look at sometimes quite popular topics from a slightly different angle is a really good way of trying to forge a career, because if you can see, you know, the angle, or, you know, the player or the tactic, or, you know, the little detail that other people don't spot, that's that's your unique value. There are so many people trying to get into the industry, and if you can stand out by offering some kind of, you know, whether it's great writing, whether it's great insight, whether it's great contact, whether it's some sort of specific knowledge, that's really the way to stand out. And you kind of do have to stand out these days, because it is an incredibly competitive industry on both sides of the Atlantic, I think.
Now, one thing I wanted to ask you about was, during the 2018 Baseball World Series, you flew all the way out to Los Angeles and wrote a terrific long piece, a column with an outsider's perspective on baseball. What were some of the things that stood out to you the most about that experience?
Ah, well, yeah, that was incredible. Don't ask me who played. It was the Dodgers, and it was the Dodgers and the Red Sox, I think.
Yes, that's right.
Well, I suppose the interesting thing. I'm a massive cricket fan, and obviously cricket is the superior sport in every aspect. So I was coming to baseball from that kind of perspective, but also slightly wary of doing that outsider's piece. Look at that, they play songs, you know, they play Take Me Out to the Ballpark, and they have big foam fingers and they eat hot dogs. Wow. I think that could get slightly trite at times. So what I was really, really fascinated by, and this is obviously going to be second nature to any baseball fan out there, was just how hard it is to hit a baseball. It's like this thing traveling at roughly the speed of sound, that's kind of swinging through the air, and you have this tiny little, a cricket bat is, I think, 3 or 4 inches wide. It's certainly like wider than a baseball bat, and you get a lot more time to see it. Hitting baseball is just, it's one of the hardest things in sport. That's really what impressed me, how these incredibly good guys, incredibly talented guys who have worked their way up the ladder and spent years of their lives hitting baseballs are still basically not going to hit it most of the time. That's really what stood out to me.
Yeah, no, it's a terrific piece. I encourage everyone who's listening to Google it and read it. How different did reporting about American sports feel to you?
Very different. I did an NFL game at Twickenham in London a couple of years ago, but I've never really covered US sport in the US. So yeah, you have to get used to the different rhythms. I was very lucky to be at that. Well, lucky, I guess, is the word, to be at that. You know, the marathon game. Was that game 3?
Oh, yeah.
The one that went on for
it never ended.
7 hours.
Yeah, it never ended. Crazy.
It never ended, and the cadence of a sport is something that takes a while to get used to. Cricket, for example, has these incredibly concentrated micro moments of action. But essentially, you're sitting there for 7 hours and you might not see anything interesting. Baseball seems to be quite similar to that, in a way that you really have to watch and watch and watch before you see something worth seeing. But in a way, that just makes it so much more worth seeing, if that makes any sense.
I mean, the rimshot joke is that you got to see the longest World Series game in history, and oh, he's a cricket writer, showing how much I know about cricket. Actually, my very brief story is that I lived in South Africa for a year in 2009 because my wife was working there, and the Indian Premier League T20 had moved to South Africa that year after a terrorism incident India. And so we were living literally down the street from the cricket ground in Johannesburg. And one day I Googled Cricket Explained and read it, and then fell in love with the Indian Premier League that season, subscribed to a specific cable channel for it, and totally got into it. And for our listeners out there, T20 cricket is not test cricket. This is like T20 cricket is like sort of the length of a baseball game, basically.
Yeah, 3 hours generally.
How do you cover cricket anyway, man? Like, or at least the kind of cricket that takes so many hours and days to finish.
It's one of the beauties of the game. I think now we're really talking about what I want to talk about here. It's one of the beauties of cricket is that, you know, you can get a 3-hour game, or if you'd been in South Africa 70 years earlier in 1939, you would have seen the legendary timeless test between England and South Africa, which went on for I think 10 or 11 days. They still didn't finish it. The English team, they literally had to stop the game because the English team had to get the boat home and they're going to miss it. So it's one of those games where, yes, you have to watch it for a long time because the important things don't necessarily reveal themselves at the time. You watch how a bowler is trying to figure out a batsman, and sometimes it'll take an hour and the bowler will be bowling it outside off stump and the batsman will leave it alone and leave it alone and leave it alone, and you think, well, this isn't very interesting. But if you think about it, what he's actually trying to do, he's trying to test the batsman's patience. You look at where the fielders are, you look at what the ball's doing, whether it's moving off the straight or not, whether it's seaming or swinging, and there are all these tiny little micro duels that are contained within a game. And for me, the key to what sort of deciphering a game of cricket is to identify those little mini battles. I mean, they say that it's an individual sport within a team sport, and I think that's really true. It's very kind of mano a mano at times, and if you can identify those little moments, I think that's one of the big keys to kind of understanding what I guess is a really esoteric game to outsiders.
Now, how do you feel about 2020 cricket? Are you sort of a purist in disdain, or do you like it?
No, I think it's great. I mean, one of the greatest games I ever covered was in Kolkata three years ago, the World 2020 final between the West Indies and England, which is definitely worth YouTubing if you've got the time. It's definitely a different sort of feel to it. I mean, we talked about cadence, and the whole point of 2020 is that there's very little room to breathe. I was brought up on Test cricket. I was brought up watching England playing Test cricket in the 90s, or more accurately, trying to play it, which they didn't always do very well. I think there's a different feel to 2020, and that doesn't necessarily mean it's a poorer game. The way that things like analytics and sports science have kind of transformed cricket would not have been possible without 2020 and the money that's come into it. There's some really interesting things happening in terms of analyzing kind of player performances and player matchups and the techniques of the game that, you know, has really enriched cricket as a whole. I think it's a fantastic spectacle. Whether it's and it's clearly the future of the game. Whether there is room in the future for kind of both formats of cricket to coexist, that's the more worrying question, I think.
We're talking with Jonathan Liu of The Independent in the UK, and winding up here, really appreciate the time you're taking to talk. I wanted to ask about your favorite interviewees. Who are some of the favorite interviews that you've done, and why?
Can we go sort of outside soccer here as well?
We can.
Okay. Well, the one that springs to mind, while I try and think of a footballer, is Mark Cavendish, the cyclist who won the world championship in 2011. I've interviewed him a couple of years later, and one of the reasons I really enjoyed that is because Mark Cavendish he's kind of got a reputation for being a little bit snippy with reporters, especially those who he feels that aren't worthy of his time. He's kind of a big kid in a way, but also like a really, really intelligent young man. Even though he doesn't say a huge amount, or he often doesn't say a huge amount that's interesting, if you sort of get into his head a little bit, mm-hmm. he will actually say some incredibly interesting stuff. And what I discovered, I can't remember how I discovered this, was that he's really into puzzles. Mm-hmm. He's incredibly into things like Sudoku, all these sort of, you know, the Japanese puzzles that you get in the newspaper, mm-hmm. and he had loads of them on his iPad. And we just got talking about that. and through that, I sort of discovered that the way he sees the last 250 meters of a bike sprint is very similar to the way it's almost like a puzzle. So he feels where the wind's coming from. He feels where, you know, the camber of the road is. He sees where the trains are moving to the left and right of him, and he sort of picks his way through the melee in the same way that he'd solve a puzzle. And that, to me, was like a really interesting insight. So that's what I quite enjoyed doing, because, to be honest, that could have gone either way. And I was quite pleased that that went quite well. In terms of footballers, there may be a theme developing here. I recently did one with Trent Alexander-Arnold, mm-hmm. at the Liverpool player, and his kind of his love of chess. Hmm. And again, this is what I was talking about earlier, about undercovered angles to quite popular athletes and teams. Trent Alexander-Arnold's really into chess, and a few months ago he played the world champion Magnus Carlsen in some, it was kind of this publicity event,
right.
And he played Magnus Carlsen, the world champion, and lost. But talking to him afterwards, it was really interesting to see how he saw the game of chess and how that helped him approach the game of football. And that's the sort of insight that you often don't get from footballers. He's a really, really intelligent young man, Alexander-Arnold, and a lot of the time with footballers, you kind of get platitudes and there's very little you can do about it. So when you get somebody who can speak intelligently and open up, that's a really gratifying thing.
Fantastic. I'm a big fan of anybody who comes to an interview sort of willing to reveal something about themselves that shows what they're about. And sometimes you have to steer them there a little bit, and sometimes it doesn't work. But I'm always fascinated by the process of interviewing. And it sounds like you are too.
I'm terrible at it. You're very good, but having looked at your book, you seem to be pretty good at it. So once we're done here, if you could stay on the line and I'll pick your brain for a bit.
I wanted to wind up with a question that I usually ask athletes, but I'm going to ask you as well. Since you are a relatively young guy, you've got a lot of your career ahead of you. What would you like to do in your career?
Oh gosh. About sort of 5 or 6 years ago, I had a really glib answer to this question, which was to kind of exhaust the sporting world, move into kind of general writing and column writing and feature writing, build a big enough profile for myself, and eventually launch a bid to be mayor of London. That's not on the bucket list anymore. I've been incredibly lucky in my career in that, very early on in my career, the London Olympics came along and I covered that. And then there was a World Cup in Brazil, and having the opportunity to cover so many different sports has kind of taken me all over the world. So in terms of bucket list items, it's not really so much about what I'd like to cover anymore. I suppose it's more about, I'd just like to keep writing nice things, and not necessarily just covering things in a really sort of mundane way, which I think a lot of sports writing does tend to towards the headers and volleys, he said, she said, this kind of stuff. Good writing has not only the opportunity to change people's minds, but also open people's minds. And I know that sounds a little bit like a Hallmark sentiment, but what we do with the platform that we're very fortunate to have is speak to people. We can go into people's phones and devices and their living rooms and kind of give them a little window on the world. And whether it's things like race, things like sexism, or even the simple joys of a third division game in the middle of nowhere, I think that there's something really quite noble about that. Being able to go to an event and saying, actually, this is what it was like to be there, and I'm very pleased to be able to convey that to you. And so I don't know if that's an answer, but I'll just that's what I'd like to keep doing for a while yet.
It's a great answer. We're pretty privileged to be able to do what we do, and I'm in my 40s, but I don't take it for granted. It is pretty clear that you don't either. Jonathan Liu, he's the chief sports writer for The Independent in the UK. You can find him on Twitter at Jonathan Liu, LIEW, rhymes with view. Jonathan, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you so much. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Planet Football Podcast. I'd like to thank Jonathan Liu, as well as everyone at Cadence 13 and Sports Illustrated, who supports this podcast. Just a quick reminder, it's a huge help if you subscribe to, rate, and review the podcast. It helps people find us. And check out the 30-minute Planet Football video show hosted by me and Luis Miguel Echegaray on SITV. That's available on SI.TV, Amazon Channels, and Fubo TV. See you next time.